Welcome back, everyone. This is time for the Dhamma talk and perhaps a bit of meditation. So before I begin the talk, I would like to pay homage to the Buddha and the Triple Gem. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhasa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhasa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhasa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namāsāmi. Our theme for today has been recollection of the body, recollection of the body as one of the four protective meditations. So these four meditations are a collection of traditional practices that weren't actually taught by the Buddha as a group this way. They were grouped together later in about the 4th or 5th century as a set of practices that could support folks who were serious practitioners on the path. And so we might ask ourselves, first of all, what is it that the Dhamma is protecting us from? And I would suggest that it's not some kind of magical talisman or anything otherworldly like that. It's actually protecting us from our own ignorance, from our own delusion and confusion about the way things really are. In fact, you can imagine that the way knowing and seeing the way things actually are, you might recall, is one of the ways that the Buddha described the fruit of this path. One would come to know and see things as they actually are. And in so doing, find one's peace with that, one's natural place within that. So much of what I hope to talk about tonight is about this kind of realism, compassionate realism with regard to our bodies. Because these bodies are, in fact, the stuff we have to work with. These bodies and these minds. So grounding ourselves in a realistic understanding of the body has been our theme for today. our aim, and we're doing this by means of the practice of Asubha Nusati. So if we break that word down a bit, the end part, the anusati, is it means recollection or to a reflection, contemplation. And that first part, as I think was mentioned earlier today, is the asubha. And the asubha, that word, so it comes from a Vedic root. It comes from a tradition that was there in northern India prior to the Buddhist teachings. So shubha is a word, a Sanskrit word, that means bright or shining or pleasant. And so in Pali, we take out these most of these sh sounds, and it's because it's a more simplified pronunciation in Pali language. And Pali is the language in which the Theravada texts have been preserved. So in the Pali language, then it's subha. And then the in the beginning is a negation. So not shining, not bright, not pleasant. And this is a way of the Buddha trying to bring us back into a balance, right? Because there is this tendency, very natural human tendency, to get swept up in our attraction to other people's bodies, to our own bodies, to certain kinds of standards of beauty, or the opposite of that, aversion to kinds of bodies, perhaps even aversion to one's own body. Right? So the Buddha is trying to give us a teaching that will bring us into balance, and as was also mentioned earlier today, a kind of coolness. A coolness about our experience of the body. Because coming from that place of balance and coolness and realism about the embodied nature of life is a path to a deep acceptance. Acceptance of what it means to be a human being. Not a Pollyanna kind of acceptance that says everything is perfectly okay, but rather an acceptance that says, I'm willing to be with what really is and see it for what it is. And this kind of coolness can have all kinds of beneficial effects in our lives. Aya Khema, a German woman who became a Theravada nun a while back, she's no longer with us, but she was one of the pioneers of reestablishing the nun's order. And Aya Khema would joke, so when I'm angry with someone, is it that I'm angry with their lungs? Or is it that I'm angry with their teeth? Or is it that I'm angry with their spleen? Like, what part exactly was it? Huh? What part was it? So it's a lovely way of her expressing the fruits of this kind of practice, understanding the body as parts, our own bodies and other people's bodies, as made up of parts. So traditionally there are 31 or 32, 31 parts, and then the brain was added later, so 32 total parts, according to Bhikkhu Bodhi, that became the additional piece that made it a nice round number, are recited in the reflection on the 32 parts. And are recited. You can find it in the chant book, actually, the Aloka Vihara chant book, and that link is going to be on your supplemental resources page. So no need to go there right now, but at some point in the future, if you'd like to check it out, you can have a look at the entire list. But for now, I would like to talk about the first five parts on the list, the so-called five externals. Five externals. And these five are actually recited in the Theravada ordination ceremony. They're recited by the preceptor, and then they are recited by the candidate who's taking ordination. I believe as a reminder, right? As a reminder that we need to practice skillfully with these external parts of our bodies. So the five externals are the kesa, the hair of the head, and loma, the hair of the body, and naka, the nails, fingernails, and toenails too. Danta, the teeth, and tacho, the skin. Yeah, so the five external parts of the body. And we tend to think of our bodies as belonging to us, as saying something about who we are, as a kind of statement to the world. Right? How you wear your hair, or whether your teeth are white. Or whether your skin is wrinkled, or any number of different ways that we think about the body as saying something about us, or us managing the body in order to say what we want to say about us. So I just want to say a few words about each one of these five. And again, we'll start with the hair of the head. And so hair is a big deal, right? It might reveal your age. It might reveal something about your ethnicity. It might reveal something about your fashion sensibility or your rejection of fashion sensibility. Or your health. So many things that people interpret from the hair. When I was living in San Francisco, at a monastery there in San Francisco for a while, I would get on the bus. And And people would approach me and say, "Oh, I'm so sorry that you are going through cancer treatment," because I didn't have any hair. And they assumed that that was because I was in chemotherapy. So it's a very kind thing to say, but really inaccurate, right? It wasn't, thankfully, that wasn't what was happening. And even in the Buddha's time, that was true, that hair had a meaning, and that people interpreted something by a person's hair. And I want to share a little bit of the Buddha's teaching regarding the hair. I'm quoting from Gil Fronsdal's translation, fairly recent translation of the Dhammapada. So from the Khuddaka Nikaya, the Buddha's, I think many people know the Dhammapada, right? Short, very short, pithy verses by the Buddha on a variety of topics. And so these are verses 393 and 394, in case you want to look that up at some other point. Maybe we'll get that on the supplemental page too. He says, "Not by matted hair, not by clan, not by birth does one become a Brahmin." So, and here, this word Brahmin refers to a person of high spiritual attainment. It's kind of a more general term. Not by matted hair. So the ascetics of the Buddha's time would do that, right? They would just not bother with their hair at all. And so it would get all matted and tangled and grow very long. That's still the case, actually, for some ascetics in India today. Not by matted hair, nor by clan, meaning your family or your lineage. Not by birth does one become a person of high attainment. The one in whom there is truth and Dhamma is the one who is pure, is a Brahmin. And then he goes on, he says, "Fool!" He's getting very strong in his exhortation. "Fool, what use is matted hair? What use is a deerskin robe? The tangled jungle is within you, and yet you groom the outside." The tangled jungle is within you, and yet you groom the outside. So what the Buddha was pointing out there was that even folks who had become seekers and left their family lives and many other things behind could get caught up in having their hair be a symbol of attainment or a symbol of some kind of experience. And yet he points out that investing energy in that is not quite going to help us make progress on the path. It's not quite the direction in which to go. So hair is a big deal, and it can be a big deal, and yet we can also look at it as just simply something that's happening, a bodily phenomena. Then you have hair of the body. So similarly, beard or hair under your armpits, deciding whether or not to shave your legs for folks who might want to do that. Is it really worth the energy? What is it saying, really? And then you have the nails. So nails is kind of an interesting one. Some people have nails that prove that they don't have to do manual labor. This is also very common in ancient China. Right? Letting the nails go really long as a way of showing that you had a certain kind of privilege in life. Or just funky colors for fun, right? Nails are also a place where folks can invest their energy. And then teeth also, sometimes a sign of privilege, whether, you know, it's not surprising that folks who want to become actors or people on the stage or on television, oftentimes the first thing they do is they go and get their teeth fixed, right? They get their teeth whitened and replaced with something very, very standard rather than the natural teeth they had. And then skin, right? Skin could be tattooed, could be wrinkled, could be of any of a wide variety of shades of colors, could be smooth. Freckled, all sorts of things, right? And it's certainly true that there has been a lot of meaning invested in that, in the color of people's skin or the kind of skin that people had, whether it was well cared for or not. I think modern science has shown that concepts of race based on the color of people's skin or certain measurements of their skulls or various other ways that people tried to define race physically are actually not biologically true. They're actually not provable as meaning anything. But there are lots of social constructs, just as there were in the Buddha's time, around skin and the meaning of the color of skin that we deal with, no matter what it is that our skin looks like. But there could be, as I said earlier, a kind of deep acceptance that can come out of this practice. And the way that we hear the Buddha talk about that is in the Satipatthana. So one of the places, so the 32 parts, the recollection of the 32 of the body parts appears in various places in the suttas, but one of them is in the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. In the first foundation of mindfulness, which is mindfulness of body. At least in the Pali texts. And the Buddha gives us a simile in the Satipatthana about mindfulness of the parts of the body. And strictly speaking, it's not a mindfulness practice. Actually, Venerable Anālayo talks about that in his most recent book on the Satipatthana. Strictly speaking, it is a recollection or a kind of contemplation practice. But the Buddha gave this simile. He said, well, the body is like a bag of grain with openings at both ends. So there are these bags of grains that are used to sow the field. And it's open at one end, so you could put the grain in the top and you hold it closed at the bottom, and then you allow it to open a little bit at a time, and the grain, the seeds, would fall into the ground so that you could plant them. So the Buddha says, yes, the body is like that. It's like a bag of grains with openings at either end. And one might look in the bag of grains and see, oh, there is rice, and there's beans, and there's this other kind of rice, and so on. And just notice, oh, there are these different parts of the body like that. And so I like this simile. I enjoy the simile because I think, right, who would get excited or disgusted actually about a bag of beans or a bag of rice? Right? No big deal. No big deal. So if we look at these five externals as a whole, there are some overall aspects that you can discern. One of them is that they are primarily earth element. So although all the parts of the body have all the four basic elements or five basic elements, as we saw in the meditation earlier, these are primarily earth element. And one of the main attributes of earth element is stability. Stability, groundedness, steadiness. It's just earth element. Nothing to get too fired up about. And also, as we have been talking about, I really enjoy the fact that we don't do a lot of coordination. And yet when these retreats happen like this and we're co-leading these retreats, it invariably works out that we are weaving these teachings together. Also understanding the parts of the body as parts of nature. Right, subject to the same principles of nature as all the other things, all the other earth element things. And in particular, we might think about the way in which these things are demonstrating what are called the three marks of existence, right? The anicca, anatta, dukkha, so impermanence, the body showing us impermanence moment after moment, literally moment after moment. So many processes happening in an instant that you can't even really pin it down. That's how fleeting this body is. Change happening at all times. The body is not in our control. It is slipping through our hands at all times. And it's also demonstrating this principle, the body is also demonstrating this principle of not self. Or perhaps non-self is a better way to think about it. So non-self and the principle of emptiness go together. And what they really mean is that this thing that we call body and mind is really just a set of conditions, causes and conditions that are expressing the principles of reality. And also based in those principles, nourished by, we cannot be present as human beings unless we have the conditions that are necessary for our presence here. So we're both vulnerable to that, that kind of need for the constant conditions, the constant adjustment of conditions and interplay within our environment. But it also implies, in addition to this vulnerability, it implies a certain kind of interdependence. And so I want to tell you a little story about that. That interdependence. So when I was practicing training in Japan, my teacher, my root teacher, Harada Roshi, had two heart attacks in the course of a week. The first one was misdiagnosed, unfortunately. They thought he just had a backache, actually. And then the second one was bigger. And so Roshi, which is his title, which means dear old teacher, Roshi was taken to the hospital in the middle of a retreat like this, actually. And he went to the hospital, and a few days later, I and all of his other students who were in residence there at the monastery were told that he was probably dying. He would probably be dying within the next few days. And so we were going to be taken in groups of three to go see him in the hospital and say our goodbyes. And so, and the hospital was kind of far away. It was a little bit over an hour away, the particular hospital that had the cardiac specialty. So that's where he was. And in the car on the way there, I was thinking and thinking about what would be an appropriate thing to say to Roshi, given the fact that he might die, and also given the fact that my Japanese is really terrible and there wasn't going to be a translator there, and what would really be meaningful in that moment and possible even. And so we arrived at the hospital, myself and the other two people, and went to his bedside. And Roshi was lying there in the bed. He was a very small man, very slight of body, and he was very weak because of what had happened. And I realized in that moment, I hadn't even thought about it until then, that I'd never touched him or held his hand. We had a very relatively formal relationship because of the style of practice that was done there. Even though it was also a very personal relationship, but there wasn't any kind of contact like that. So I went and I sat down on the bed, I sat down next to the bed and held his hand for the first time ever. And was actually surprised at how strong and warm his hand was, even though he was quite weak at that moment. And I said to him what was probably the first thing that I'd ever, the first teaching that I'd ever understood him to say to me in a one-on-one interview in Japanese. So he spoke Japanese and I spoke English, and we had help usually when we were trying to have a conversation. But he'd given me this one teaching that was perfect for this moment. And the teaching that he had given was, "Watashi to anata wa futatsu denai," means you and I are not two things. And he didn't use the word for two people. In Japanese, there's a different word for two people. That's futari. He didn't use that word. He had used the word two things. So in that moment at his bedside, I said to him, "Watashi to anata wa futatsu denai," you and I are not two things. And what did Roshi say in response to that? Roshi said, "Thank you." Arigato, arigato, arigato gozaimasu. Arigato, 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 arigato. He said, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, until I left about 10 minutes later to give somebody else an opportunity to say their goodbye to him. He just kept saying, thank you. And to be clear, what this teaching is saying is not that we are one. He didn't say we're one. He said we're not two, meaning we are interdependent. We are interconnected beings. That's how we're built. To be interconnected and interdependent with one another and with our entire environment and everything even beyond that, step by step, bit by bit. When you look up at a star in the sky, the night sky, that light reaches your eye and makes contact with your eye. Having traveled, I don't know how many trillions of light years, that star might not even be there anymore because of the amount of time that it took for that light to reach your eye. And yet, across space and across time, you are also connected with that star. It's not magic. It's how we're built. And it's looking at the third mark of existence. It's when we miss that point, when we are ignorant of that, when we feel the sense of separation and the sense of wanting this body to be permanent and to be separate from all of the process nature of a human life, that we suffer. That we run headlong into the fact of our own confusion. So, if there's any message that I would like to leave you with tonight, it's that when it comes to this body, parts are parts. And that is both a beautiful thing and a vulnerability. And to the extent that we can let that be true, then we will find peace with it. We will find our ability to be with it. But if you try to fight it, then you're literally fighting nature. You're literally fighting the entire cosmos informing you as a human being. So when it comes to these parts, these so-called external parts, and how we decide to present ourselves to the world and how the world decides to respond to us, if we are doing this practice, we can start from that place of knowing what's real right here, right now. And let that give us a deep grounding. And an ability to flow with it. Because even the earth flows. even this earth especially, flows. So that is what I wanted to share with you this evening. Thank you all for your practice and attention. And what I'd like to do then is just go ahead and move into a little bit of sitting in stillness, practicing in stillness, taking this in for just about 20 minutes or so. And then we'll move on to the closing chant of the evening. So find a posture, a sitting posture, or a standing posture, or a lying down posture that will allow you to feel stable. Supported by the earth. A posture that is alert and aware, tuned in, and relaxed, a posture that allows you to relax. No need to be doing much of anything, just being still with this body. And this mind.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.